You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You just found the very best in original talk radio broadcasting on the internet. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want. What we want. You're listening to On the Couch, On the Couch with Dr. Michelle on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially On the Couch. Welcome. You know, lately I've been talking to the media about newsmakers and events, as usual, particularly about sociopaths and murderers with psychosis. Specifically, I've been talking about Adam Lanza, who gunned down 20 children and 6 educators in Aurora, Colorado. And, of course, I did a big piece on that theater gunman, James Holmes. You know, that guy? Yeah, we see his scary face in the media and in the courtroom. Too much, actually, I think. But anyway, we have to do that. You know, most of us can't imagine why and how someone would do this. What is up with that? Is it purely psychosis? Is it a sociopath who's cunning and planning and has no sense of conscience? Who is that? Who are these people? Well, my special guest today is psychiatrist and author Mark Rubenstein. He's going to talk about the demons lurking inside us and others. Dr. Rubenstein is a physician turned psychiatrist who also taught at Cornell University while continuing his psychiatric practice. He's authored 5 books, 6 books now. His latest one is called Mad Dog House. It's actually a provocative psychological thriller. So welcome to the show, Mark. So nice to have you with me.
Thank you, Michelle. Great to be here with you.
Well, listen, I really enjoyed reading your book.
That's great to hear.
You know, being a psychologist and all, I love psychological thrillers. I'm not going to reveal much about the book here because I want you all to, if you want a good read, if you're into novels, especially a lot of my listeners have book clubs and they're trying to figure out which books are compelling to talk about. So this would be one for any person or group who likes to get together and talks about provocative, you know, books who really make you think about things. Can you give listeners a kind of a tease about the story of your book, Mark?
Sure, Michelle. The book concerns a man named Roddy Dolan. He's a successful suburban surgeon living just north of New York City. And he grew up under rather adverse circumstances, a terrible childhood and upbringing, which he left behind him. It was a childhood that in some respects was so bad, he nearly went to jail at age 17, ooh, except for the intervention of a kindly judge and some other people, all of which is in the novel. Now he's in his early to mid 40s, and he's approached by an old friend from the old neighborhood, one Kenny Egan, who suggests that Roddy and his best friend and blood brother from the old days, Danny Burns, join him in an undertaking as silent partners in a New York steakhouse. Roddy is kind of wary because he's living a great life. He's married to a lovely woman who's a librarian, and they have 2 children, and he's very wary of this suggestion, but he consults with his blood brother, Danny Burns, and they decide to go into this vanity venture, this little project. It would be a great trophy, really illustrating how far the two of them have come in their lives from their rather difficult upbringing.
Yeah.
And Roddy is very, very certain that he's buried his rather checkered past behind, and he joins into this venture and discovers that Danny is very quickly sucked into the high-energy glitz of the restaurant and the New York steakhouse nightlife.
Yeah.
They find themselves amidst the glitter of the New York nightlife, and lo and behold, as can occur in steakhouses, there are mafia honchos and Russian thugs, and things start to spin out of control, and the next thing you know, the lives that Roddy and Danny knew all their lives, or at least all their adult lives, are over. They have changed. And certain things occur that are not only life-threatening to them, but to their families. And Roddy must call upon his mad dog substrate, if you will, his own past, his own inclinations from when he was a kid, and figure out how to get out of this fix. And I've just given you, I think, a teaser for the novel.
That's a good teaser. I think that's perfect. You know, there's always situations and people who come to us in our lives. And, of course, you have been a psychiatrist and a teaching professor at Cornell University for years. And you see all kinds of patients who have issues. What and who inspired you to write this book?
Well, I could talk forever about that. Yeah. I've been asked that question a number of times, and each time I answer it, the answer sort of becomes a bit more complex and convoluted. I'll try and give you the short version, okay, Michelle?
Okay, you got it.
It was almost a dreamlike process for me. I think that in some respects, my mind entered into some semi-conscious period. I can only compare it when I try to reconstruct how this novel came about. It's somewhat like the experience we've all had. You know, you wake up in the morning and you know you've been dreaming, and the dream is just in that little recess somewhere in your mind, and you try and recapture it, and as each second passes, it just fragments and it's gone, and you can't recapture it. It's as though you've been resurrected from a sleeping state and the dream has just evaporated. But let me give you what I can reconstruct in terms of just the first few pages, and I think it'll really be emblematic of what happened in terms of the entire novel.
Yes.
As you know, Michelle, because you read it, the novel begins with a scene from Roddy's childhood when he's 12 years old, where a bully named Cootie is finger snapping his ear because Roddy's sitting in front of him. I must tell you that when I was in the ninth grade and I weighed a prodigious 105 pounds, there was a much taller kid who was doing that to me. And he did it again and again, day in, day out. Call it bullying, call it what you will. I was a skinny kid, but I came from a tough neighborhood. So after a number of days of this, and the finger snapping went on the third or the fourth time, and my ear was again feeling like a hot ember, I turned around and I challenged him to meet me behind the candy store across the street from the high school. I was a freshman, and I could almost smell his fear at that point, because like most bullies, he was just taken aback that a skinny kid like I was would take him to task. Well, we went behind the school, the candy store, and long story short, I really took care of him very handily.
Oh,
it was really a pushover. One of the great triumphs, here I am a thousand years later remembering it. So that's partly how the book began. Also, in the seventh grade, there was a kid in my class whose nickname was Cootie. Don't ask me why.
Uh-oh.
He was not a bully. He was the class clown, but everybody called him Cootie, and so did I. And so these elements of a Cootie and the finger snapping and a fight behind the candy store of the school comprise the opening scene of Mad Dog House. And it really occurs on the first four or five pages of the book, as you know.
Right.
And what I found happening is that many of the issues of my own life, my own thoughts and feelings and fantasies kind of coalesced and morphed into not only the first three, 4 pages of Mad Dog House, but also into the novel. You know, I grew up in a tough neighborhood.
Got into
lots of fights as a kid. I got a degree in business in college, didn't know what I wanted to do with it, but in those days, the Army and the draft loomed over everybody as soon as you graduated. So I went into the Army, and I learned plenty about guns and certainly about violence, and I took care of paratroopers in the 82nd
yes.
Airborne as a medical corpsman.
I was so taken by these
experiences that I just got out and I went back to college, took the pre-medical sciences, went to medical school, was fortunate enough to get accepted, and became a doctor, and then eventually found that psychiatry was mm-hmm. so appealing because, unlike the rest of medicine, every patient has a different story to tell in
right.
psychiatry, and storytelling, of course, was something that really appealed to me and still does.
Wow.
Bottom line is yep. all of this coalesced and came out in this novel. I always loved restaurants, although I fortunately never owned one,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of the long and the short of how some of this came about. And as I wrote, things changed and morphed again, and I had to go back and change some of the beginning, but it all eventuated in this pure fiction called Mad Dog House.
Yeah, pure fiction, but there are realistic characters in there, that's for sure. By the way, in case you just tuned in here to LA Talk Radio, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle here and my special guest today, psychiatrist and author Dr. Mark Rubenstein. We're talking about his latest book entitled Mad Dog House, which he just said it's a provocative psychological thriller based on real characters, real people, and it's a great read. In case you're interested in calling in and asking the good doctor a question, you can do so right here live on the air at 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or also, if you're shy, you don't want to get your voice on the air or your name or whatever, what you can do is email me right now at docmichelle with two L's at AOL.com. I'll be happy to take some of your questions, and we'll go from there. How's that? Now, we're talking about Mad Dog House, and you say that in your book that it provokes people to think about the demons that may be lurking inside. My voice gets weird when I say that. I like to say it like that. The demons that may be lurking inside our loved ones, or perhaps ourselves. Now, what do you mean by demons lurking and the haunting power of the past? What's that about?
Well, about the past, at the beginning of the book, I have two quotes. One of them that I really love is by William Faulkner, who says, "The past is never dead. Mm. It's not even past."
Oh.
All of us take our past with us. And, a guy named Sigmund Freud long ago, actually not so long ago, coined the term that he called the repetition compulsion.
Yes.
And we all know people who've repeated the past or past patterns again and again and again. A young man who goes out with a certain kind of woman who rejects him, or a young woman who manages always to find men who are in some way cold and indifferent, perhaps a replica of mom, or perhaps the very opposite of what mom was, and she was a smother mother or a helicopter parent, as they're sometimes called today.
Yep.
But we all carry the past with us. It never really goes away. Demons lurking inside, we all have, for lack of a better term, an angry, rageful, even vengeful and mean side. We are taught early in life, if we're brought up a certain way, that this is not the way to be, so we really smother and suppress much of that as best we can. But think about the arc of history, and think about the world as it exists. I don't know how many wars are going on right now.
Yes.
Violence is just part of life and has been since human beings populated the earth.
Yep.
Rage, violence, jealousy, all of these, as they sometimes say in psychology, all of these id-driven kinds of states, these instinctual states, including love, are part of us, and we can't escape them no matter what we try to do. Think about all the people on the freeway who end up rubbernecking when they pass an accident on the side of the road.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Violence and blood and gore, even though we try to disavow them, they really appeal to us. So we are in many ways creatures of our past. We're hunted and haunted by our pasts, and we live out some of our pasts. Of course, if we're fortunate, we overcome some of these meaner tendencies, and we sublimate,
Right, exactly.
He's a surgeon. And as a surgeon, some people will say that surgeons are really very sadistic people who sublimated their sadism into cutting people up, but in a very productive and helpful way. I don't know if that's really true, but, you know, that's one way perhaps of looking at it. So demons and ghosts of the past are part of us. There's another quote that I have at the beginning of Mad Dog House that says, the one thing you must know and remember is that everything you are now has come down through a final common pathway to the present moment.
Well, I agree. It's so true. It's so true. It's not.
Michelle, you and I are on the same page.
Well, we really are. And, you know, it's just kind of a side note here. You see a lot of folks, and I do too, who are unfortunately victims of inheriting psychiatric disorders. Whether it be psychosis, whether it be bipolar with psychosis, whether it be even major depressive disorder or major, you know, anxiety states of serious panic issues. And people who don't have these chemical imbalances, you know, they can do pretty well with even with trauma in their lives early on if they can sort of learn and get through the pathways. But it is difficult for much more difficult for a lot of folks who do have these chemical imbalances and are trying to figure out how to function in the present along with their old imprints from early messages that they were given about their worthlessness or abuse, verbal, physical abuse, that kind of thing. So it's it's a very, you know, it's not easy. And then living in this society with, like you said, so much outward violence going on in the media, and especially these mass shootings, which I want to talk about too. It's amazing how we all sort of do so well. You know?
It's amazing that we all haven't fallen down the rabbit hole. It really is. By the way, you know, as part of what you're saying and even perhaps alluding to, do you know the two most prescribed medications in the pharmacopoeia of American medicine today?
Well,
I don't know. Neither one of them is insulin, believe me. it used to be Prozac.
Right.
Now it may be a combination of Prozac, Wellbutrin, and a couple of others. It's one of the antidepressants, and the other one is Xanax.
Oh, yes. And that's dangerous. Those benzodiazepines are very dangerous.
Oh, yes, they're addictive, and they can impair you in terms of your cognitive functioning and other things. But I think it speaks to the prevalence of anxiety and depression and panic and phobic phenomena and really a kind of dysfunction that can at times appear to be rampant throughout our society.
Isn't that amazing? I do think, though, a lot of physicians, psychiatrists, specialists are sort of, for the most part, really trying to manage these types of medications. Not necessarily antidepressants, but I'm talking about, you know, the tranquilizers and, of course, the narcotics.
Yeah.
They're trying to be more mindful of the situations going on in our society with people who are addicted to these particular. So, you know, they're not only covering their own behinds, but I mean, they're making sure that people aren't going to get hurt or hurt others.
They're trying, they're trying. These are, you know, the generic term, I guess, would be psychotropic medications.
Yeah.
Those medications that have an affinity for the psyche or the mind or the brain, actually.
Yeah.
They're all brain-altering chemicals. But, you know, they address symptoms, which can be fine. I've been asked many times about Roddy Dolan in Mad Dog House.
Yeah.
You know, how does he manage? How does he change? After all, he doesn't really have any symptoms. What you're talking about with Roddy is character or character armor. That's difficult to change.
Mm.
We can always try to manage symptoms, even the most psychotic symptoms, if the patient complies, can be managed with appropriate medications.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to get somebody to change that repetition compulsion, that pattern of behavior, that character armor, or the character pathology, that can be more than difficult. That can be almost impossible with some people.
Boy, it's so true, Mark. You know, By the way, in case you just tuned in here on LA Talk Radio, you are on the couch with Dr. Michelle here and my special guest today, psychiatrist and author, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. His book is called Mad Dog House. It's a great book. It's a provocative psychological thriller. And we're talking about, right now, character armor, as you call it. Now, my listeners are very familiar with my discussions about what we call personality disorders, or in the community, access to cluster Bs. you know,
cluster B, yes.
Right? And we're not laughing. We're saying, wow, this is personality disorders are the most difficult to treat. Because they don't usually change. The personality issues, or character armor, or as they call them in AA, defects, which kind of turns me off a little bit, you know, is pervasive. They stay with us throughout our lives. And what is that about, Mark? Why once a liar, once a thief, once a killer who is sociopath? Why is that happening? Why does that stay with us?
Why does that, did you say chase us? Or?
Yeah, why does that stay with us, that personality flaw?
Okay. I would just want to make one very simple but important differentiation. When we talk about character traits, we're not necessarily talking about pathology. We're really talking about a person's way of being in the world, of seeing, of perceiving, and reacting to other people. Mm-hmm. When it becomes a personality disorder is when the person's behavior, when his or her way of seeing and reacting to and dealing with people becomes problematic and causes either other people to experience discomfort and difficulty, or causes the person himself to run into trouble, then it's a disorder because it has social behavioral consequences. So character armor or character traits are very we always, by the way, differentiate between trait and state. Trait being just the way you are. State being a symptomatic state, let's say severe depression or anxiety or panic or a phobic state. These are acute, very discomforting states to find oneself in. And my God, people want to get rid of states very quickly. They run to the doctor. But character traits, hardly anybody ever goes until and unless the traits start getting them in trouble, in which event we're talking about a personality disorder.
Yes,
they are with us. They are with people. Traits as well as personality disorders. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they are part of a person's characteristic way of being, of simply being. I like to say, you know, many of the patients who've come to see me over the years, most of them have come because of symptoms. Symptoms, however, with some frequency arising from character traits or character armor, because they've been dealing with people in a certain way and certain things have happened and they've ended up becoming acutely anxious or depressed or whatever. But character traits and character personality disorders can be extremely difficult to make changes with. I often draw the analogy between them and looking at a 45-degree angle in geometry, let's say. If you can change that angle by 2 degrees or 3 degrees, you may be able to affect a very meaningful change in a person's ability to nip things in the bud and not be quite as, let's say, obnoxious as they were, or quite as forthcoming as they were. They may be able to put a filter on themselves a little bit more readily, or engage in some kind of behaviors that are less difficult for others to deal with than they were prior to that time. So that can be the goal in psychotherapy or on the couch, as well as symptom eradication or reduction. And the whole issue of how much can we really change is way up in the air. It's, you know, there's the old nature nurture controversy.
Right.
Are we the way we are because of how we were brought up, namely nurtured, or is it just in our nature, like the proverbial scorpion carrying the frog across the lake?
Well, it's both. I don't think
it is certainly.
I don't think there's always, you know, a particular, you know, it's many different factors. many different factors, you know, that come
absolutely
into our lives.
As Roddy says in the novel, he's a product of a bombed out childhood.
Wow, well said. That's exactly right. So it lurks within him. You know, Mark, one of the most popular questions I get from listeners is about the rash of shootings that has been in
yes.
the news lately. Why do
yes.
you think, as a psychiatrist, that we're seeing more of these mass killings from mentally ill, I don't mean to be racial, but white male killers, shooters, the ones who killed the children and teachers in Connecticut and the clown at the Colorado movie theater during the Batman
mm-hmm.
film. Why
mm-hmm.
are we seeing more of this?
They are always male. They are almost always young. Racially, they are predominantly white. There was the one situation where the older black man and the young black kid were driving a car around the D.C. area
oh, yes.
shooting people. It goes back about 6, 7, 8 years ago. I don't know if you recall that. But you're right. They are predominantly, they are always young men and predominantly white. And why are we
yeah.
seeing this?
Yeah.
Well, I've been asked this question many times since Aurora, actually since Columbine, but
right.
more so since Aurora. And, you know, I'm from Connecticut, and I'm talking to you from Connecticut,
yeah.
and Newtown is only about 15
wow.
miles from where I am right now.
My goodness.
And on the day it happened, I went into a supermarket, and some of the employees were rushing home
wow.
because their children attended school in Newtown.
My goodness.
I can only say this. I, as a psychiatrist and as a human being, I'm appalled. You know, we look at cancer, we look at leukemia, we look at all kind of heart disease, and we all know that they can be deadly. And
yes.
we all know that there must be a public health, there are a public health issue.
Yes.
We never hear public service announcements as we do about heart attacks and cancer,
right.
And how you know early intervention saves lives. We hear them about cystic fibrosis, childhood obesity, diabetes, and so forth. You never hear anything about mental illness.
Right.
In public service announcements on the radio or on TV. And I think we need more of those. We need some of them that will destigmatize these disorders so that, because these disorders kill.
Yes.
And they can kill the afflicted person as well as other people, as Newtown so horrifyingly demonstrates. I also think our culture and entertainment have changed drastically. Michelle, do you remember the days when there was just one family TV with just a limited number of stations?
Oh, that's way before my time. No, of course, I'm kidding, Mark.
Oh,
yes,
okay,
I do. No,
I'm kidding. I'm belying my age here.
I'm kidding.
Today, the typical house has 3, 4 or more televisions
right.
with over 600 stations. Each kid has a TV in the bedroom. There's a computer or some handheld
right.
device. The music, the videos, the internet can be streamed.
Yeah.
There's, I think, less entertainment today that's life-affirming and much more that's violent. And we live in a multimodal, digitalized world that's
yeah.
becoming increasingly desensitizing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about banning anything or trampling on freedom of speech. I'm just saying we should do our best to stop supporting entertainment that glorifies violence by
yes.
just not buying into it.
Oh, boy.
I think the other element, there are a couple other elements in this escalating scenario.
Mm-hmm.
These days, I'm struck by the fact that parents, by and large, try to be friends
yes.
with their kids.
Yes.
I mean, empathy and understanding are fine,
right.
but it doesn't mean that parents relinquish their responsibility. I think parents have to band together.
Yes.
They have to guide their children. They have to speak with each other. If your kid is friendly with another kid, you should be speaking with that other kid's parents if for no other reason to get some ideas to what's going on, what kind of entertainment they're watching. Of course, these days we have very often two parents working, and it's very difficult at times to pay attention to all these things. But if we don't, it invites trouble with possibly tragic consequences.
Yes. Yes.
Another element is that kids have this unspoken coda about not ratting on
yeah.
other kids.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And I think we have to work a little harder at getting kids to realize that if a friend or classmate is acting quote unquote, strangely, it's everybody's responsibility to report that.
Boy,
you're not
isn't.
Ratting out somebody. You're
yes.
really looking out for everybody because, let's face it, we're all in this life together.
Boy, is that true. Yeah. And we don't know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry?
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, as a psychiatrist, yeah. I think it's a fact of life. I don't think I know. It's a fact of life that there are some very troubled people,
mm-hmm.
and some who are psychotic, who can't differentiate reality mm-hmm. from fantasy, and these people should never own or have access to a weapon.
Oh,
there's just
God,
no question about it.
Yeah.
There should be strict mental health background checks
yes.
as well as criminal checks before anybody can buy a purchase,
mm-hmm.
have any access to a weapon of any kind.
Yes.
I don't think it infringes on any sane person's right to bear arms.
Correct.
And there's the whole constitutional argument. I think there's another argument, there's another issue that nobody really talks about.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to revisit the HIPAA laws.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the privacy laws about some medical issues. I've had this experience myself where a 20-year-old mm-hmm. paranoid schizophrenic is
yep.
in treatment
yep.
and living with his mother.
Yep.
And his mother wants to know what's going on in the treatment because the kid is deteriorating. He lives under her roof.
Right.
He's totally dependent on her for food, clothing, and shelter. He's incapable of working.
That's right.
He is or is not taking his medication. And yet the psychiatrist or psychologist is prohibited by
That's
HIPAA
right. That's right.
law
That's right.
from discussing anything about the kid without his or her permission.
That's exactly
and
right.
To me, it defies common sense.
Right,
I understand there are laws, there are rules, regulations, and there's the Constitution, but what we need more than anything else is good old-fashioned common sense.
Oh, yes.
And I think that until we make some common sense adjustments to the scourge of mass killings that have been
yes,
going on,
yeah.
We're going to all be victims again and again and again.
Yes, yes. And, it's so true. You know, all we can do is only if someone says, I'm going to commit suicide or I'm going to kill someone else and here's my plan, or, you know, if they're gravely disabled, they can't care for themselves and they're kind of
mm-hmm.
a mess in society. We can only try to get them into, you know, the hospital, and God knows how long they're going to hold them, especially with the situation in hospitals right now. I don't know about your area,
yeah.
but and then they're out again. And if they are adults over 18, we can only try to keep them stable on the meds. We cannot
mm-hmm.
say, watch out for this person, watch out for this person, unless they
mm-hmm.
actually are threatening. And I know you've been in situations like that.
Oh, I have. You know, it reminds me of this is a famous California case. I know you've heard of it, the Tarasoff decision.
Oh, yes.
It goes back a number of years, but there was a disturbed man who was in treatment with a psychiatrist
mm-hmm.
who voiced his intention directly to the psychiatrist that he intended to kill
yes.
so-and-so.
Yes.
The psychiatrist was sued successfully,
yes.
and it was deemed a form of malpractice of medical negligence
mm-hmm.
because he had, according to the court, a duty to inform
That's right.
the intended recipient of this man's potential violence.
That's right.
And that has become law now. There is a duty to inform, but
Thank
there's
God.
No duty to, unless there's imminent danger, there's no duty to inform on anyone. And I think that really needs to be revisited. I'm not
it
a legislator
really
or a politician,
no,
but
I
think there. Yeah, I'm a psychiatrist,
yeah.
but I think that common sense dictates that we look at some of these common law resolutions and
mm-hmm.
some of the actual legislative issues and try to make them, for lack of a better term, more user-friendly.
Yeah, it is so. I agree with you. It is so true. You know, there was an article that came out. I just wanted to get your take on this, Dr. Rubenstein. It was in the Examiner. And columnist William Hamby talked about a theory he called aggrieved entitlement. He says that the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre, you know, Eric Harris and Dylan Kybold,
mm-hmm.
said to girls who were in a group asking them why they were doing this, he replied while shooting People constantly made fun of me and make fun of my face, my hair, my shirts. And he said, we've always wanted to do this. This is payback. This is for all the you put us through. This is what you deserve. Do you think there are more people out there like this who are coming out who have been bullied? And we were talking about bullying earlier. Do you think more people have held this anger in for so long, now they're getting revenge?
Well, you know, that's in some ways it's a question that is almost impossible to answer for a number of reasons. One is the media today is 24/7 with the news cable channels and so forth.
Yeah.
So they're always finding something to report and to comment on, even if it's not particularly newsworthy. I'm not talking about a massacre. I'm talking about some other issues that people seem to be talking about, even though they're not particularly newsworthy. The other thing is there. You know, as long as human beings are alive and living on this planet, there will always be unfairness. There will always be bullying.
Yeah.
There will always be people who are aggrieved. And it's really, I guess, a matter of degree. It's like psychopathology. It's like any disease state, be it physical or mental. It's a matter of degree that determines the extent to which the person, either physically or emotionally, is compromised.
Yeah.
We all have our difficulties. There's not a human being alive who can claim a totally clean mental slate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a matter of degree. And, yes, I think we're always going to be burdened by some kind of horrific event. The question is, can we cut down on them? I think there's a chance we can with a reasonable common sense solution, some of which I've just tried to mention briefly.
Yes.
You know, what will happen in terms of politically, legislatively, who knows?
Wow, that's so true. Yeah.
Yeah, these are I think burning issues of domestic issues of our time. They really are. The desensitization of our kids, the culture of violence, and I see some of the ads for these video games.
Yeah.
People are cartoonized.
Oh my
they
God.
Really are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's and I look at some of the previews of the movies with the CGI and the way there are just explosions and people leaping off buildings and doing things that are humanly impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that on young impressionable minds, this must have some effect in terms of turning the universe into some cartoonish kind of a de facto symbol of I don't even know what. It can't be a healthy thing.
Yeah,
I hate to sound like an old conservative or something, but yeah, you know, again, I think that a common sense perspective on this is what's called for.
Yeah, exactly. Mark, we have an email that I think is fascinating. And relevant. would you like to take a shot at it here? we have a question from Sean, who just wrote in, and he said, I'm into college football. Can you tell me about the Manny Te'o case where Renaya, I guess it's Tula Osopo, pretended to be a woman who wanted an online relationship with Manti for 4 years? He asks, what type of personality would want to catfish others on the internet and cause people to become emotionally involved with a false person that they've created? That's a great question. Great question, Sean.
It is. It's a very interesting question. I must confess, by the way, I've not kept up with the scuttlebutt on this case.
Yes.
You know, I don't know all the details of it.
Sure.
It's one of those things that the media has jumped on because of the Heisman Trophy and you know, so forth. But, you know, it brings up the whole question of online relationships. Mm. As far as this hoax, or whatever you want to call it, assuming it was a hoax and that he himself didn't have much of a part or any part in it, there have always been pranks and pranksterism. You know, people ordering pizzas in the name of other people and stuff like that. It's gone on since the telephone came into being. The technology today, however, allows people to do things like cyberstalking. Talking and cyber relationships and even cyber sexual predation that was unheard of 15 or 20 years ago. I can only say in a general way that someone who would prefer or selectively seek out a cyber relationship with someone has got to be a person who really in some way is obviously fearful of what real intimacy is all about. It's very difficult to say more than that. I understand it's a generalization. But how can an online relationship, or for that matter, even a telephone relationship, begin to approximate the interpersonal connectedness, the physicality, the emotions, the thoughts and feelings and behaviors that are encompassed in a real human, living flesh-to-flesh kind of relationship?
Yes.
It can't be.
No, it can't be. But what I think is concerning Sean here, and I agree, is the individual who would perpetrate this hoax, it's not just a phone call. It's a four-year relationship that he kept going, and he actually called Manai on the phone as a woman, disguising his voice and having conversations with him.
Oh, I didn't even know it was a man who was doing this.
It was a man who was doing this, and this
oh,
is.
Oh wow!
The thing that's
I did
really,
not. As I said, I haven't been following the case.
Yeah.
Oh God, who knows? Oh, now we're talking about an element of psychopathology that I don't know. I'd have to talk to this person face to face to get a little bit of a bead on, you know, who, how, and why. I mean, is there a homosexual kind of thing involved? Is there some kind of sadism involved? Who knows?
All that. I think there is. I think there's a gay and jealousy and needing to be recognized. And I mean, but the deception is so evil to me. To trick this guy into thinking that, you know, oh, I have this wonderful, and he of course falsified some poor woman's picture on the internet, you know, who came out and said, wait a minute, this is me. My name's Diane. I'm not this Lene person. And, you know, so it all unfolded to where it's a kind of a scary thing that people are catfishing, as
they
call it.
Yeah. It's like a virus.
Yeah.
Pathology will always evolve and will find new ways of expression and new entry points into the cellular organism known as a human being.
Yep. Boy, you said it. That's well put.
I tried.
You said it. And a perfect way to wrap things up here. We're almost out of time, Dr. Rubenstein. But I want to let listeners know how they can get a hold of your book and find out more about you.
Okay, well, my website is Mark Rubenstein, that's MarkRubenstein-author.com.
Great.
That's MarkRubenstein-author.com. They can get the book is online as a Kindle for $2.99 at Amazon. It can also be purchased as a trade paperback on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, IndieBound.org, and it's available in most bookstores. It will soon be available on all e-readers sometime by the middle of February. And Mad Dog House is, it can be read on three or four different levels. It's not just a story.
That's right. It's a provocative psychological thriller focusing on the demons lurking inside ourselves and others. Love it. Great stuff, and kept me riveted all the way to the last page.
Well, the last page does tell you what's the final. By the way, I must say, Michelle, the next one coming out is called Love Gone Mad, which has nothing to do with Mad Dog House.
Oh, okay.
But Mad Dog House has generated a certain response where in Amazon reviews, of which there are now 136, people are asking for a sequel. So
All right.
began writing a sequel,
Good deal.
I'm 40,000 words into that now. And that'll be coming out after Mad Dog Justice. But there are certain loose ends, as I know you know, at the end of Mad Dog House.
Yeah.
There's certain unfinished business. And while I wrote it as a standalone novel, I've been roped into doing a sequel.
Well, hey, that's a great reason. And come on back back to LA Talk Radio here on the couch with me when that comes out as well. So
that would be great. I'd love to. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Oh, you're welcome, Mark. A pleasure to have you on the show today. And
it was my pleasure.
Oh, keep in touch.
I will.
Thank you. Take good care now.
Bye bye.
All right, Mark Rubenstein actually is how you properly pronounce it, and he's the author of Mad Dog House. psychological thriller. Find out more about why people do things and all that. And, of course, if you ever have any questions here about my special guest, myself, what's going on in the media, you can email me at docmichelle@AOL.com, docmichelle with two L's at AOL.com. And, of course, we'll be back next week. We're going to find out about how hypnotherapy can help you get through a lot of issues, whether it be an addiction, an emotion, an issue within yourself. Great stuff. All right, have a great day, and as always, do say here on the couch is do take care of yourself first. Take care of yourself first, and then you'll be good for others. That's the way it works in life. Have a good week. It's Dr. Michelle Cohen. Bye-bye.